Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
For our second lecture, we're going to have David Goldstein, who will speak about energy efficiency in appliances, and especially his favorite topic, refrigerators. And he has the topic, if SUVs were as efficient as refrigerators, America would be exporting oil. And in addition, we will have David Green speaking as a discussant. And of course, we will have you, the audience, participating in a discussion afterwards. So think about questions for David Goldstein. And now, David.
Thank you very much, everyone. Particularly, thank you, Alan, for inviting me to participate in this event. Refrigerators are an interesting story in their own right, but they're also interesting as a metaphor for what could be done with energy efficiency, what needs to be done with energy efficiency across the whole range of end uses. So that's why we're going to focus on them here. I'm going to first put them into a context, why refrigerators are something we should focus on, and describe how it changed the world. Again, this is a metaphor for what we could do with energy efficiency policy across the board. And if there's time, I'm going to tie this to the Great Recession. That's what we're in right now. This story begins in the 1970s, where the California Public Utilities Commission, like most regulatory commissions and the Department of Interior, which turned into DOE, were projecting 5% compound growth in electricity, which was down from about 6 or 7% that had happened previously. As Alan, I think, mentioned, the people who did this graph had no idea what was causing it. They knew residential, commercial, and industrial separately, but they didn't know refrigerators or light bulbs or anything like that. That was all buried inside the details. So, for example, nationally, the Department of Interior was forecasting 7% growth forever. And part of that was 1 terawatt of nuclear power plants that would already be operating right now. A terawatt is bigger than the capacity of the entire power system in the United States, as it actually turned out to be. Art Rosenfeld and I looked at efficiency potential and projected this kind of curve. You would think that a projection of 5% growth forever would be pretty easy to refute. It was not. In fact, Art and I were asked to step down from our positions by a major utility who was trying to get the University of California to curb these radical thinkers who thought you might actually be able to do something about this growth curve. California was the leader in not only doing something about it, but in getting the data on which to do something. This chart, you've seen Jackie display a bigger version of this that doesn't cut off in 1974, but you have to look at it this way to see what planners were thinking at the time. This is the energy use per refrigerator, but if you start aggregating it up to household growth and more than one refrigerator per household over here compared to about 0.8 over here, this turns into a 9.5% compound growth rate. 9.5% by coincidence was also the compound growth rate of the entire residential sector. So even though they didn't know it at the time, the people who were projecting this 6% growth were essentially saying refrigerators were a prototypical example of it, and they would continue to grow at this rate forever, and multi-billion dollar investments would be made around the country based on the hypothesis that this was going to continue to happen. What does this extrapolate to today? 330 gigawatts of power. That compares to 120 that the entire nuclear program produces. So when you compare, as Alan did, end uses with supply side, you get some pretty startling results. So California passed the Warren-Alquist Act in 1975 and started to do something about it. What did they start to do? Note the high graphics technologies of the 1970s. This is an original chart. We went out and we looked at what refrigerators were out there as a function of volume and energy consumption and tried to see, could you just lop off the top of this distribution and come up with something reasonable? And sure enough, you could. So you didn't even have to get into the engineering. What about the economics? Well, you can look at the purchase price based on, compared to the operating cost, both in dollars. This is a bunch of graduate students shopping in appliance stores, getting the data points. And look at the lifetime costs, which were big, $2,000 in 1975 dollars. And you can see that by improving efficiency, you can cut the costs dramatically. So this is a pretty strong evidence that you can not only save a lot of energy, but you could do it cost effectively. So the commission started looking at standards, which would be imposed in two tiers, and compared them by product class. You know, you used to have to defrost refrigerators at that time, for those of you who aren't gray-haired. You can see that they set standards at levels that would exclude, say, the upper two-thirds of energy consumption of the marketplace. These were pre-standards comparisons. Post-standards, this is a distribution function. Again, note also the contemporary graphics. Of the efficiencies of refrigerators before the standard was implemented. This is how many of them are there versus how much energy consumption. The standard was set over here, so only these amount could still be sold. And then afterward, you saw very good compliance with the standard, and actually a few of them that did a little bit better. Why do they do a little bit better? Well, because utilities in California had started offering rebates for X percent better than the standard by the late 70s or early 1980s. So there was a reason for manufacturers to do better. Interestingly, the data source for this is national. So what we saw is that manufacturers found it easier to meet California standards in 50 states than to produce the 49-state model and the California model separately. So this is a great success of the first round of standards. So let's look at what you can do next. The utility programs in that distribution function showed that you could probably go a little bit lower than the standard. So the Energy Commission, in response to an NRDC petition, started a proceeding in 1983 to look at how much farther you could go. Why was it California? Well, it was California because the Department of Energy in the Reagan administration thought appliance standards weren't a good idea, even though they were required by law to do them. And it took the states and NRDC and others 5 years almost to win the lawsuit, where the court agreed with us that, yes, indeed, you can't change what Congress asked you to do just because you don't happen to believe in it. But we didn't want to wait that long, so California started looking at a more sophisticated technique. This is engineering analysis. Much of it was DOE-funded research, starting with high energy use and seeing how purchase price would increase as you went down. But the important thing is here, compared to 1979 California, you could cut energy use by well over a half based on known technologies with DOE research behind them. So the Energy Commission looked at this and set a really interesting standard. They set a standard based on about this level with an effectiveness date of 1992. This is a level that was not met by a single American-made refrigerator in the market at the time. So this standard was based entirely on this engineering analysis of what you could do. It was kind of the poster child for a technology-forcing standard. And it would raise the cost of a refrigerator by a little over $100. Lawrence Berkeley Lab was doing supply curves for saved energy in refrigerators, and came to a fairly similar conclusion, if you crunch the numbers here, that if you tried to get to this level of about 60% savings, you would raise the cost of a fridge by $125, but it would be cost effective. Well, that might have made some people nervous. We're requiring something that doesn't exist in the United States. But it turns out, when I was traveling in Japan, they had very legible labels on refrigerator energy use, and this is what Japanese refrigerators seemed to do in 1984 compared to American. Well, that seems a pretty clear example that you can mass produce this stuff. Unless they calculate kilowatt hours differently, which it turns out they do. So Lawrence Berkeley Lab had to do a study trying to import a few Japanese refrigerators and test them according to an American test cycle. This slide, however, points out that even if you were worried about the test procedure, the most recent models were substantially better than the 2 years ago models. So relative improvement is certainly happening, even if you're not sure about absolute improvement. But here's the Japanese numbers corrected for test method, which is still below the proposed and eventually adopted California energy efficiency standard. Once this started happening, we were able to go to other states with similar kinds of scatter plots of what currently exists and what we're going to propose. And this Massachusetts proposal was identical to the California proposal, so it's evidence of how California changed the world also. This is a cost curve, a typical U-shaped cost curve going lower energy consumption as we go here. And this says that the minimum of the curve is about 200 kilowatt hours per year, which is half where we are today. So this says the commission was fairly conservative in setting a number at this level. What are we going to do about this level? Well, it turns out that we were experiencing at the time another environmental issue with refrigerators, which is the refrigerant they used and the chemical they used to blow the foam and make it so thermally resistant was causing ozone depletion. So we had to phase out ozone-depleting chemicals at the same time of improving energy efficiency. If you aren't very thoughtful about it, these are two separate processes and they compete with each other because they chose these refrigerants for good reason. They were the most efficient. So the question is, how do you get them to solve both of these problems simultaneously and use new chemicals that will improve both the energy efficiency and the emissions characteristics? That's what we did in the 1990s. California Utilities took the lead in saying, well, you know, you've got to redesign everything to get to 1992. We're going to give you a rebate and we'll announce it in advance for getting 10% better and 15% better. California Utilities and the Energy Commission and NRDC were also in the lead in establishing what was called the Golden Carrot Program. The words golden carrot were Gary Fernstrom's coinage from PG&E, which would say, well, you know, as long as you're going to redesign this refrigerator anyway, we'll give you $30 million if you can produce the most cost-effective savings of at least 25% beyond the standard and reduce ozone depletion by at least 90% at the same time. Well, here's the effect of the rebate programs in California. We're going this way, we're going to years, and this way we're going to more efficiency. And you can see as the new standard went into effect, this yellow curve, we were getting a lot of sales of products 10% better. This next curve, we were starting to get a bunch of 15% products. The golden carrot result, we had 14 bidders, so industry was obviously quite interested. The winning bidder produced refrigerators 30% and then 40% better than the standard in a very cost-effective way. We overtook Japan. So yeah, we're changing the world. We're demonstrating that America can pull out of an efficiency deficit and move into the forefront of efficiency. You've seen this before. I want to point out the policy intervention. Standards here, rebates here, 1, 2, 3 standards here, and this negotiated standard based on the golden carrot, because refrigerator manufacturers who either built a 30% model or had to compete with one knew enough about these technologies, which they wouldn't have known otherwise, because if no one's going to buy a more efficient refrigerator, why is it worth even learning how to do it? And if you don't know how to do it, you're certainly not going to agree to a standard that compels you to do it. So this was the first negotiated standard, and we're down practically to World War II levels with a product that's 3 times bigger, actually keeps the ice cream firm, is quieter, and has a much bigger freezer compartment. And this is actually where we are on average. Energy Star is 20% below, and tax credits are offered for products 30% below. So you can even do beyond this. The moral of this story that I'll get back to in a second is continuous improvement. This is sort of a Moore's Law curve. You can fit it not too badly to an exponential of declining energy consumption. This is not limited to refrigerators, as Jackie pointed out. Refrigerators do better because, one, we paid more policy attention to them, as we should have, because they were the biggest single user of electricity in the home when we got started on this. And second, because a refrigerator is a complete system, but an AC or a furnace is a part of a system, and the rest of it is the windows, which you'll hear about this afternoon, and the insulation and the duct ceiling. So when you fold all those in, here's how California has cut energy use by two-thirds for air conditioning over the past 30 years. These are Energy Commission numbers. Oh, and by the way, this house was 1,500 square foot, and this one's 2,400 square foot, and I haven't even normalized, or the commission didn't even normalize for that. So this, like refrigerators, is Moore's Law with an exponent of 4 to 5% per year, 4 to 5% continual improvement. Now let me show you the most amazing thing about this continual improvement, because I left something out of the previous refrigerator graph that's critical. That's the cost. Every step along the way in standards, the cost was going to go up $50, $80, $30, but it would be a couple-year payback. Here's the cost in green. It goes down every year. If you looked at this curve and you didn't look at when the energy use went down, you wouldn't see it from this curve. There is no step in cost that corresponds to a step in energy efficiency. The only little increase in cost here is about the time that the CFCs were phased out for ozone depletion. So that one might have had a little bit of a cost. So the point here is, if you establish a real market in energy efficiency through performance-based standards and through financial incentives and keep them continuous, which we didn't quite succeed in refrigerators, but we came close, you will get continuous improvements in technology that drive down the costs every year. Now, when I first prepared this graph, I started saying the costs went down despite required increases in energy efficiency. But I realized that the word despite is wrong. The costs went down because of the increases in energy efficiency. Because a company that's ignoring a three-year payback in its products is probably ignoring three-year paybacks in its own production processes. So energy efficiency might cost more if you do it on its own, but you never do. Now I want to get back to continuous improvement. If you have real functioning markets, which we are getting, which we have gotten to some extent for refrigerators, you get continuous improvement. And let me show you two examples of continuous improvement: a BlackBerry or an iPhone and a digital camera. Here, the product characteristics that are improving are very visible to the consumer, so markets function. And they get better every couple years. You wouldn't want a four-year-old BlackBerry. But the other thing is, if I had asked Panasonic in 1995, could you produce a camera that outperforms a film camera in quality, takes 4,000 pictures on a roll instead of 40, and weighs 150 grams instead of 1,500 grams for the film camera, they would have said, I don't know how to do it. Because that's not how you make technology progress. You make technology progress by being 20% better per year or 5% better per year, because you know if you develop the technology, it's going to sell competitively. And that is the key to what we need to do for energy efficiency, not just for refrigerators, but for all technologies. Specifically, the way you do it. First of all, get people's attention by setting greenhouse gas caps so that people are starting to think carbon footprint, what can I do about it? And they're receptive to the idea, whether they're producers, retailers, consumers, doesn't matter. They're receptive to the idea that we're going to have continuous improvement in new technologies. Second, standards, because as Jackie Fanninsteel pointed out, standards have the least cost to the government, so conservatives who don't want government to spend too much ought to like this approach. regularly revised to higher efficiency, as we've done for refrigerators, and based on performance, not on specific technologies. Second, simple normative labels like Energy Star that say this is a good product, so that the consumers who are thinking green know how to act on it and move a little bit beyond the standard. That's not enough, as we saw from Michael's talk. Sometimes you need incentives. And I refer to managed incentives because this means that you don't know how successful a rebate program is going to be. So maybe you offer a rebate and no one comes, so you got to spend a little bit more money. Or conversely, maybe these things are selling like hotcakes and you need to cut off the program before you break the bank. So utilities in California, at least, manage these programs and achieve energy goals at a minimum cost and living within budgets. Long-term incentives. Golden Carrot was an example of this. You need to do something that is going to induce manufacturers to develop new technologies and to build the assembly lines to mass produce them. And that means they need financial security. They need to know that this money is there no matter what happens. One way we've tried to do this on a national level, but with strong leadership from California, including Senator Feinstein as a co-author of the bill, is to set very ambitious targets, maybe a tenth of a percent market share or less, and offer financial incentives that are guaranteed, and that's what the tax system does because the IRS doesn't have a budget for rebates. People claim a tax credit, they get it, that's it. And those need to have very ambitious goals for one thing so that you don't break the bank, and for another, because if they have low goals, then why did you need this special intervention? You could get it through a utility program. So utility programs basically count on state of the shelf because the utility doesn't want to offer a rebate to its customers and then you go to Walmart and you can't find the product and so they're just selling frustration. But for a tax credit, you can do that. How successful have the tax credits been? The Snow-Feinstein tax credit, Senator Snow is a Republican from Maine who is the co-author, proving that this stuff can be bipartisan, as the California per capita energy consumption graph also does. The incentives for air conditioners were set at a level where I was asked in 2004, can three manufacturers even meet this level? And I looked at it and said, well, three brand names can meet it. I'm not sure it's three manufacturers, but it's eight products anyway. Well, eight out of how many? Well, about 120,000. But in 2006 and 2007, where we have data, California utilities promoted the air conditioner tax credit, and 15% of all replacement air conditioners in California met that level. New homes. We set the new home level at the DOE program level. Well, actually, we required really 50% savings, and DOE was letting its builders get away with the mid-40s. Oh, and the air conditioner standard went up to SEER 13 in the meantime, so it was 50% of a lower target. We just got the data from 2008, so I can report that the first year this tax credit for new homes was in effect, we got a 1% share of the new construction market. The second year, we got a 3% share. The third year, which was last year, we got about 2% fewer homes than we did in 2007, while the entire new construction market fell by almost 50%. So this was insulated from the housing crash, and we're up to 4.5% market share. So this stuff really works. We also need to do these other things that Jackie talked about. I'll mention location-efficient development because we've done a pretty lousy job of that so far, both in California and nationally, although we have SB 375 which passed and was signed last year that hopefully is going to push us on the right track. I'm going to close with the answer of how do we get people's attention? How are we going to maintain a focus on energy efficiency in the middle of the worst recession since the Great Depression? And the answer is that this recession did not come about by accident. It is an expression of structural problems that have been widely written about in the American economy going back 8 and 10 and 20 years. And all of them are directly related to bad energy efficiency policy. If we're going to get out of the hole, we've got to stop digging ourselves into it first. And so a fundamental condition, I believe, for recovering from the recession is fixing the energy efficiency policy problem at the national level as well as statewide, actually at the global level. Causes of the recession, the mortgage meltdown, that's the direct cause. But their energy is going to appear in that indirectly in two ways, and I'll get to the most interesting one in two slides. Risk of inflation. That's a big problem with the economy. Even this month, when we had actual deflation, the Fed is saying, oh, but we're worried about inflation coming back in years to come. And what is inflation caused by? Inflation is caused by energy prices. The inflationary outbreak of 1973 was caused by energy prices, 1979 was caused by energy prices, and the economic analysis here says the last couple years of inflation was caused by energy prices. Energy efficiency keeps price down. That's what we discovered in 2001 when we spent $1 billion on energy efficiency and avoided $40 billion in excess costs for electricity that we would have had as a result of deregulation. We avoided them entirely by reducing demand so much that the price for electricity went down. Risk of inflation and the mortgage meltdown. How do you fight inflation? You raise interest rates. What happens when you raise interest rates after 3 years of low interest rates and lots of variable rate mortgages being written? You get a mortgage meltdown. Trade deficit. Last year, trade deficit was 38% energy. Low savings rate. How are you going to get consumer spending up when we're not saving any money? This is a fundamental problem unless you invest in three-year paybacks. Then you can borrow the money, get the consumer spending, business spending, and pay it all back to the Chinese in 3 years. Productivity increases that are too low. Investing in three-year paybacks is a great way to improve productivity, and as we saw from the price curve of refrigerators, inducing manufacturers to get competitive and creative also improves productivity. Government deficits. Government's a big energy user. Make government more efficient, the deficit goes down. Here's an obscure way. Energy costs are tax deductible if you run a business. The government is subsidizing energy waste to the tune of 35%. If you induce business to use less energy, they have to make more tax payments because they're making more profit. And the government gets 35%. Jobs. Energy efficiency is a pretty hard thing to outsource because if you're retrofitting a home, you have to have a guy on site to do it and to inspect it. Or the same for an office, or the same for a business. If you're retrofitting it with windows, it's really hard to ship windows long distances. If you're retrofitting it with insulation, most insulation is made domestically too. So there's a lot more job content in energy efficiency than anything else. And besides which, since it's a three-year payback, you're saving all this money from efficiency, which instead of going overseas in part of the trade deficit, creates economic multipliers here at home. Oh yeah, I said I was going to get back to the mortgage meltdown and energy efficiency. Over a 30-year life of a mortgage, a typical home in suburban sprawl has a median price of $160,000. It was $200,000 when I made up the slide, but now it's down to $160,000. 30-year commitment to utility costs is $75,000, more if carbon pricing comes in, as it will in the next couple years. But the cost to drive to and from the home is $300,000. When the bank asks, are you credit worthy? They look at the 160 and they ignore the 375. Is this a recipe for failure or what? So you would expect, given this, that energy-efficient homes and location-efficient homes default less. Well, for energy-efficient homes, we're starting to see some evidence that even this relatively small signal of saving 10 or 20% of 75,000 leads to a better record on defaults. For location efficiency, we don't have a statistical study, but if you look at a map of location efficiency for Northern California from green to red, green is compact transit-served areas, red is suburban sprawl, and you look next to it at a map of defaults as a percentage of all properties, you are looking at one and the same map. If you do this for cities outside of California, It's a little more squishy in terms of trying to compensate for income and, you know, what places have been growing versus what places haven't. And someone really ought to spend $100,000 doing statistics to get to the root of $1 trillion worth of economic damage. But if you look at it intuitively, it is completely evident that the results will show that we've got a hidden cause of the mortgage meltdown, which is totally unaddressed, but could be addressed through good energy efficiency policy. How would you do this? Very simply, by considering the sum of all those three costs when qualifying people for a home. Does anyone know someone who moved away from the Bay Area who didn't want to because they could afford a home closer to here? And maybe they're trading $300 a month of mortgage savings for $500 a month of transportation costs. So not only aren't they getting to exercise consumer sovereignty in choosing where to live, but they're less secure as a borrower, and they're using a lot of energy unnecessarily, and they're making smart growth developments less attractive to developers because they can't afford to buy into them. So here's a way of addressing all of these problems at once. So I'm going to conclude by noting some of the specific areas on this slide where California has been exercising world leadership. I should mention decoupling, which Jackie brought up at the beginning, and rewarding utilities for success and efficiency as something that isn't up on this graph. But in all these areas, we're seeing California taking the lead and getting followed by the rest of the country, by other countries, and throughout the world. So I'd like to encourage us, out of a sense of California pride, if nothing else, to keep up this good record. Thank you very much.
And David actually brings the SUV perspective on this. David is a transportation expert, and maybe can, with luck, we will hear some of his views about why SUVs can't be like refrigerators, or could be like refrigerators.
The reason I'm speaking about California's role in transportation is because I don't know anything about appliances and refrigerators. I have the pleasure to serve on the American Physical Society Committee with David. And that convinced me that he knows all about this stuff and I don't. All I know about refrigerators is they do keep my beer cold, and that's important to me. But that makes me think, this slogan, cold houses and warm beer. If your house is cold, why is your beer warm? I don't get that. But anyway, example of faulty logic, I think. So I think California's role in vehicle efficiency is less well known, maybe less well understood, but really not less important. And I would cite two very important things that California has pioneered in that area. One of them Alan already mentioned, but I want to underline it. The first is to prove that performance-based technology pulling regulation could work for motor vehicles. And they did this through the motor vehicle emission standards. And there's been quite an astounding success. A vehicle that qualifies for California's SULEV emission standards emits about 1/1,000th of the pollution of a vehicle prior to there being any standards. 1/1,000th. You can imagine what the air would be like today if cars were emitting 1,000 times more pollution. So I think proving that that kind of standard would work for automobiles was a key fundamental achievement that enabled the regulators in Washington, or the Congress in Washington in 1975 to pass fuel economy standards for the United States. And the second point is the one that Alan already mentioned, and that is to create the information. You can't regulate, you can't have effective policy regulation without information, without good data. And to create the test cycle concept that allowed a consistent basis. Now, there's a lot of argument about how accurate are these fuel economy ratings and so on, but that's a different subject. I'd be happy to comment on it later. But you have to have a consistent, meaningful basis that gives you a measure of energy efficiency in order to regulate it. And that also was invented here in California. I should say I'm speaking not as a Californian. I'm here at the University of California, Davis, in the Institute for Transportation Studies for 9 months, enjoying myself tremendously. I'm really from Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, where I've been for 30 years. So I'm speaking really from an outsider observing. The importance of the data is really critical. I've had the privilege to work with the China Energy Foundation, the China Automotive Transportation Research Group in China, on their fuel economy standards. And one of the biggest problems they're facing at this point in enforcing the standards is the lack of good data. So having that test cycle, having that data available is critically important. That is, in a sense, the institutional infrastructure, if you will, the policy technos that allows you to have fuel economy standards. And those fuel economy standards were very effective. I have two slides. Enough of the refrigerator slide. We're now into the transportation equivalent of the refrigerator slides. But this slide shows the efficiency in miles per gallon of passenger cars and light trucks from 1975 to last year, well, 2008. And it's very clear to anyone looking at this slide that the fuel economy standards, which are the solid lines, essentially drove the improvements in miles per gallon. And some people like to say, no, pay no attention to this kind of information. It was the price of gasoline. Well, we all know the price of gasoline went up. The price of gasoline came down. The price of gasoline went up, stayed down for 15 years almost. Now it came up again. That did not drive this. I have some papers on the subject. But in any case, this was driven by this improvement in new car fuel economy on the test cycle was driven by the fuel economy standards. And that, I think, is perfectly evident from this graph. But then there's a question, okay, so you have improved fuel economy on this test cycle, which is in a laboratory. What did you get in the real world? And in the real world, they also worked. If we had not improved fuel economy over 1975 levels, American consumers would be using 75 billion gallons more gasoline than they are today. 75 billion gallons, that's a lot. That, I think, is the equivalent of the refrigerator graph for transportation. And although California did not set the fuel economy standards, they created the technology that was needed by policymakers to set those standards. Now, I want to say again that California today is taking the lead, and when we look back in the future, we'll see that as well in establishing the Pavli standards for greenhouse gas emissions. And I, as well as some others here in the room, had the privilege to testify as an unpaid expert witness on behalf of the Northeast states in Vermont, and I'm very happy to say that the judge ruled in favor of the Northeast states. They were suing the Northeast states, which obviously had adopted the Pavli standards. But we won on every single point down the line. And that, I think, shows that California had the right idea and was moving in the right direction. And we just had this morning, of course, the Environmental Protection Agency announce that, yes, indeed, greenhouse gases are pollutants, and they do need to be regulated, and they have consequences for human welfare and human health. So big, important achievements coming largely with the leadership of California. And I think as we look forward in the future, we know we have to solve our greenhouse gas problem, we know we have to solve our oil dependence problem, and we have to do it at the same time. And one of the reasons we can do both of those things at the same time is energy efficiency. Energy efficiency will serve both of those goals tremendously, and it will enable us to accomplish both of those goals, even though there may be some conflict at certain points. If we have energy efficiency and we pursue energy efficiency, those conflicts can be overcome. So this concludes my remarks on the subject, and I look forward to questions.
Hi, my name is Josh Raisin. I work at the Heshang Mahon Group, and my question is, about the SUVs, sort of. Is there any reason why U.S. CAFE standards should not be increased to match the European standards or even Mexican standards that currently exist and are higher? And would there be a way to use the lessons from the refrigerators of having an equivalent to the utilities with a golden carrot to prompt that?
Well, of course, you know that the U.S. in 2007 did raise the CAFE standards with the Energy Independence and Security Act to 35 miles per gallon. I think that that level is achievable with conventional technology at costs in which the fuel savings will more than pay for the additional cost of the technology. So in a way, that's easy, should be easy to do. It will require major changes on the part of the automobile manufacturers to their vehicles, but it is achievable with conventional technologies, known, proven today, and so on. So should we go beyond that? Absolutely, we should go beyond that. And I think it will be hard in because of the politics of having set those standards and everything, it will be hard to raise the standards over that same time frame, which is to 2020. But I think we really need to look beyond 2020 and employ this concept that David talked about, which is continuous improvement. If you look at my first graph, you see improvement up through about 1982 and then nothing. Big mistake. Okay, so now we need to say, where are we going after 2020? We should be looking towards something on the order of 100% improvement in fuel economy over today's levels by 2030 is what I think we should do. So I would stick with our path to 2020, but just make sure we keep going.
I want to reemphasize something that David Green just said about the fact that it was a mistake to let fuel economy standards stagnate for 20 years. And that's one of the differences between refrigerators and cars. The other difference is when we talk about CAFE, the CA stands for corporate average, and you're averaging in the performance of a smart car with a Chevrolet Suburban. Refrigerators have a big difference in product amenity, too. You have a little 3-cubic-foot refrigerator that you stick in a dorm room, and you have a 27-cubic-foot refrigerator that you could practically buy a side of beef and put it in the freezer compartment. And refrigerators, the Commission was, I think, cleverer than the Congress was when they set up CAFE in saying, no, we don't want you to average them. We're going to let the market determine what size refrigerator and what features of refrigerator you want. What we are going to do is say, for the same size of refrigerator and the same features, here's the energy consumption you have to have. There are some proposals floating around to change the fuel economy standards in that fashion. And David probably knows more about the details of them than I do, but I personally think that it would be a good idea and would have been a good idea to have regulated cars more like you regulate refrigerators.
For what specific technology applications should we be establishing golden carrot programs?
Well, I guess there's two answers to that. The golden carrot was a specific type of program which was based on an RFP. It was based on competitive bids to achieve the most cost-effective level of efficiency beyond a certain point and meeting some other environmental constraints where you can get more points and win the bid. That was based around the idea that we had some knowledge about how refrigerator manufacturers make their financial decisions. And the guy on our team who understood this was able to say $30 million is the cost of designing and building an assembly line for a new product. So that is a pot that's sufficient to cause the desired result. For other products, that may or may not be the case. So for other products, you may want something more like the tax credits, which is a come one, come all kind of incentive. It says, here's the ambitious goal, and anyone who meets it for the next 3 years or 6 years gets a financial incentive. And there may be other mechanisms that we haven't even thought of yet. The main point here is to develop something that will change the economics to a manufacturer. These are manufacturer-focused programs. And just like it's cost-effective for the camera manufacturer to develop generation N plus one because they know it'll sell, you want to make it cost-effective for the product manufacturer to develop generation N plus one. And the more you know about that industry, the more fine-tuned you can develop a program on what it takes to make it profitable and what it takes at the lowest public cost.
Actually, I'll extend that to David Green. If you can perhaps answer the question, is a golden carrot program appropriate for
golden
motor vehicles?
Carrot.
A golden cart
program,
program appropriate for motor vehicles?
There are some programs such as the Hydrogen Prize, H2 Prize, and then there's the prize for the 100 mile per gallon vehicle. But I think a better strategy, really, along the lines of fiscal incentives, is the concept of feebates. Mm-hmm. And we are now at Davis and with colleagues at Berkeley doing a study for the ARB on the potential of using feebates as a policy in California. And here, I don't think California will be leading the world leading the United States. It's because in Europe, Spain, Germany, Netherlands, France all already have adopted feebate systems as a way of providing financial incentive for continuous improvement in vehicle fuel economy. The concept of feebates was actually invented here in California by, I believe, Art Rosenfeld and Debbie Gordon. They called it Drive Plus at the time. But as you saw, one of the problems we had with fuel economy standards is we raised them and then we stopped. If you have a feebate system in place, you have a continuing incentive every time a new technology comes along to think about applying that technology to improving energy efficiency instead of making vehicles more powerful or bigger. And so I think it may be that this concept can work well in conjunction with fuel economy standards in providing another dimension, another incentive to the marketplace to increase energy efficiency.
Thank you. There's a question.
Hi, this question is for either of you. My name is Jason McPhee, and I'm with the California Resources Board. I was just wondering, with the current financial state of the automotive industry, I'd just be curious to hear your insights on getting the auto manufacturers to go along with efficiency pushes?
First of all, one hopes that 2 years from now they won't be in the same shape they're in now. The standards just set by the Obama administration are for 2011. So we hope that the stimulus program will work, the economy will get back in its feet, and by 2011 we'll be doing better. I also think that competing on the basis of energy efficiency will eventually be helpful to the automotive industry rather than harmful. I think we're all moving into a world where reducing greenhouse gas emissions, energy sustainability, these are going to be continuing goals. And the winning automobile manufacturer will be the one that makes its customers happy, but also meets these objectives for energy and protecting the environment at the same time. So telling the manufacturers they have to do this is actually good for them, if you will, because it helps their industry become sustainable. We could not have the automobiles in California we have today if they were all emitting 1,000 times as much pollution. It just wouldn't work. So it's actually to the benefit of the automobile industry to have those regulations in place to make their products sustainable.
I want to agree very strongly with what you just heard. If you look at Professor Green's first graph where the line was flat and you invested in the car companies at the place where it started getting flat, you would have lost a lot of money. Apparently, firms need some kind of external kick in stable, mature industries like refrigerators or cars to maintain their competitive edge. If you invested in Whirlpool or Maytag, which were the two companies that you could buy their stock independently, you would have found you'd be a lot happier with your portfolio today because these companies thrived as they were complying with the standards and incentives.
Are there any other questions? I have one here that was submitted. How much more can we do with refrigerators? Are we approaching the theoretical limits of continual improvements? And maybe I'll add, there was a follow-up there. Do we need to start thinking of refrigerators as part of the larger heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system to get deeper gains?
Okay, the first question is, I think, important as a process, even more important than the answer. Even in the electronics industry, Moore's Law can't continue to apply forever. At some point, you do run into physical limits. So the question that needs to be asked and hasn't been attempted to be answered in a quantitative way for about 30 years or more is, what are the physics limits to how low energy use could be for various end uses? Now, I've tried to do it informally, and the conclusion I come to is that we're at least an order of magnitude or two away from physics limits in any end use that's really important. Refrigerators, we aren't that far away, because the fundamental limit on a refrigerator with perfect insulation is you're putting hot food into it, and there's a Carnot efficiency limit on how efficient an electric motor can be in moving heat from one place to another. And I haven't done the calculation. I don't know if there's even enough data to do it, but my guess is factor of 5 or factor of 10 improvement would be the best you could possibly do. But for other things like heating, the theoretical limit is 0 because you've got free sunshine that can always provide enough heat if you insulate well enough. So this is an important inquiry, I think. But clearly for refrigerators for the next decade or two, if we can sustain or improve on 5% annual gains, there's still the headroom to do it.
We have one final question.
Can you talk a little bit about the interaction between applied research as manufacturers live with it, basic research that comes out, that creates these theoretical understandings and possibilities, and the actual making of standards, and the different times at which the different sectors lead or follow?
I really like that question. The biggest lack in research at the national level has been what I'll call market-focused research, and that is to identify the specific steps needed to take a product that is almost commercial and move it to the state of full commercialization, perhaps in cooperation with manufacturers. California is actually leading the way in that with the PEER program that the Energy Commission runs, where, for example, they're taking a commercial rooftop air conditioner, which doesn't work because the dampers freeze in the wrong position, and they're either letting in hot air when they're supposed to be closed because it's afternoon in Sacramento, or they're letting in the cold air they're supposed to let in, but they do it at 6 in the morning in January. And there are other maintenance issues. So that's a research question that needs to be addressed. Much of that won't be addressed by the manufacturer unless you're in this mode of this set of policies that I showed in the last couple slides, from standards through financial incentives, that makes it worthwhile for them to do the research. Because if you can't sell your existing premium product with a 5-year payback, you're not going to develop the super premium product. You're not even going to find out how to do it. And in fact, that's one of the biggest barriers in trying to set standards based on understanding the technologies, is it would be stupid for manufacturers to know the data that you would need to know in order to decide what the next standards level is. So you either rely, as we did in the refrigerator graphs I showed, on government-sponsored research, or you're kind of shooting in the dark and you might be shooting too low. Could you remind me about the first piece of the question, because I didn't address it. Okay, theoretical. Yeah, this is an important question. Theoretical limits on energy efficiency depend on how you define the energy service that you're getting. So if you're trying to define the energy service, let's go back to the first conversation, as taking a fixture that was designed for incandescent lamps and looks like one that was designed for gas lamps because that's what it's imitating, and find a more efficacious source, you'll get one sort of answer, which in the case of a kitchen remodel I did would have given me about 200 watts of lighting for my kitchen instead of 1,000. If you define the question of how do you provide comfortable glare-free lighting on the task, then you open the door to different choice of luminaires, different choice of light sources, and I actually was able to do it with 15 to 30 watts. And I think if you're creative, and one of the previous questioners asked this about why do you define a refrigerator as a box that looks like an ice box but it's electrically powered, why don't you define it as how do I keep my food fresh? You might be able to find that you can avoid the physical limits to a more technology-based definition of what the energy service you're trying to get is.
Thank you very much, David Goldstein and David Green, for this discussion and presentation. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.